Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. For this week's literary review, I'm joined by John Mitchinson, co-founder and publisher of Unbound and writer for the British panel show QI. On today's show, we'll get a lesson in genealogy, we'll be transported to the life of a teenage girl in 1960s California, and we'll be taking a thrilling trip around the streets of 18th century New York. All that coming up on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Siddhartha Mukherjee is a cancer physician and researcher, as well as a stem cell biologist and cancer geneticist. He has published Pulitzer Prize-winning writing on cancer, and in his latest read, he's tackling genes. John, welcome to the show. The gene, an intimate history, has been dubbed a quest to decipher the master code that makes and defines humans. Where does that journey begin?
Well, it's a big claim, but one that this book actually amazingly lives up to. It's a story, on one level, it's a history of genetics. It's a history that starts with 150 years ago with Gregor Mendel, sort of isolating for the first time this idea that there is heredity, you can, with sweet peas in his case, that you can pin it down to an actual inheritable unit, the gene. That then intersects with the Darwin's idea of evolution. And then you have an extraordinary century of explosion in negative directions, the Nazi eugenics program, the Human Genome Project, the genome project that has basically rewritten the whole of the natural sciences, because we're now basing our understanding of how things are connected, not through the way things look, but actually through their genes. So it's an immensely ambitious idea that you can tell a history of this in one volume. And it's such a fundamental. This is like the key to everything. All life, including human life, in the end, can be boiled down to genetics. But it's also much more than that. He is just a remarkable writer, and he is also explores through the book. He's a practitioner, as you've already said. He's at Columbia. He's a professor of medicine, but he's also doing research into stem cells. He's certainly research into cancer, but also in his own story, mental illness, the schizophrenia that's dogged his own family. He's now looking at the genetic markers for schizophrenia. So it's a personal story. It's a brilliant scientist explaining how they do their work, and it's also a history. It kind of, for me, is, you know, if you were going to give one book to anybody and say you want to know where modern science is, this book is the one to give them.
And how much does he go into the kind of biographical side of it? Because he does use, as you say, his own family members as a kind of reference point. Does it drift sometimes from science fully into biography?
Well, again, he's such a good writer that he, you know, when you begin to feel you want to get back to the big narrative, the way he structures the book is, you know, he doesn't give you all the history and then all the, I mean, it's carefully and brilliantly interwoven.
So it's not a kind of chronological history that takes you from 1850 through to the modern day.
It kind of is, but he's moving backwards and forwards. It's sort of more thematic in its structure. But what's remarkable about it, I think, is that he never loses sight of the audience that he's writing for. I mean, I kind of like, a bit like with, you know, the Vogue, we've talked on before about the Vogue for nature writing. I'm always more interested in about the practitioners, you know, the shepherd up in the Lake District or the farmer from Herefordshire than the people who are just kind of thinking in the abstract. This is what Mukherjee is like with, he is a scientist, but he's also, I mean, if he wasn't a scientist, he could be a novelist, you know. He's so, the precision of his language and the eloquence in which he uses metaphor. There's a brilliant, the best metaphor I think I've heard for what he's doing with his work is, he said, imagine a cell contains the 66 volumes of Encyclopedia Britannica. That's all the genome in one cell. We can now go into a single volume in a single cell, and change one word without affecting anything else in any of the volumes. So not only is this, I mean, that's a beautiful way of describing what they're doing and indeed how the genomes work. But also, I think he says fairly early on in the book that this is the most powerful, most dangerous discovery, the most powerful and dangerous idea that we have. Because, of course, once we start to be able to change ourselves, once we start to be able to eliminate diseases, I mean, you know, that's why the eugenicist chapters, which are pretty horrific to read, are so important, because it's a book about the future as well. About, I mean, the genome has, you know, we're rewriting the past, but we're also, to some extent, kind of programming the future. It's a remarkable book.
The Gene, An Intimate History by Siddhartha Mukherjee is out now, published by Bodley Head. Our next book takes us to the summer of 69 in California, where we meet teenage girl Evie Boyd. The Girls is the title of the book, and it's by American writer Emma Klein. This is a tale of female adolescence, but set amid scenes of unthinkable violence that change Evie's life forever. John, I guess, first of all, why don't you set up the plot of the story for us?
Well, the plot, I guess, is as you've said, it's set in 1969. It's actually the now adult Evie looking back on her teenage self. She's 14 years old. She's, in a way, a classic sort of slightly kind of vague, slightly disturbed 14-year-old girl living in California. It's a very hot summer. Her parents are divorcing. She's waiting to go to boarding school. She has a friend called Connie that, you know, they're doing things, they're sort of inept dating, they're putting on makeup, they're doing all the stuff that teenage girls do. And then she's sort of frustrated by all this, and she finds and becomes obsessed with Suzanne, who is living on a commune, and she sort of becomes kind of, I guess, the obsession with it's about rebellion and about finding yourself. Evie, anyway, ends up becoming kind of part of the cult. The cult is run by a sort of charming but sinister figure called Russell. There is an obvious connection here with Manson, and the book, in a way, the book has been sold on the basis that it's a sort of novelization of the Manson murders. And although there is unpleasantness, I mean, without giving too much away, there's deep unpleasantness, the book is much more about the consciousness of a 14-year-old girl and her love for Suzanne and her aspiration to fit in that the book is about. It is one of those things, again, doesn't happen very often. It already feels like a sort of ready-made classic of the literature of the teenage years. And the fact that Emma Klein herself is only 26, 27 now, you can sort of see why it became it's been a massive book in the States. It sold for seven-figure sort of advanced three-book deal. And it has come wreathed with the most remarkable quotes. I mean, from Lena Dunham on the sort of popular end of the scale to, Mark Haddon saying it's a remarkable book, the novelist. James Wood, the kind of great kind of eminence grise of American, high-flown American literary criticism, saying that Emma Klein has been fast-tracked by the muses. And Richard Ford, my favourite American novelist, also saying that this is a book of remarkable powers. I mean, in a way, I don't think there's been a debut quite in the same league as this for a long time. Maybe you have to go back as far as Donna Tartt's Secret History, or in this country, White Teeth by Zadie Smith, another child prodigy, almost writing a masterpiece. So the obvious issue is going to be, does it live up to the hype?
That was going to be my next question, all of this hype. What's your opinion on it?
My opinion is it's very difficult for any novel to live up to quite the amount of hype now that novels get. And indeed, there are things in this novel that don't quite work. But the core of it, I have to say, this is a writer that we will be reading, I think, for many years to come. I mean, I hope that the early fame won't sort of, in a way, force her into a sort of kind of aesthetic dead end, because she sort of feels she's written. You know, she comes from California. She's got lots of sisters. Her sisters have been brilliantly protective of her on social media. So she's, her parents were winemakers. In a funny kind of way, you do feel that she's put a lot of herself into her first novel, like most novelists do. But her, I think everybody, I can see why it went for so much money. It's a book that it is a page turner. You kind of, the larger picture of this sort of how this kind of teenage crush in the end becomes kind of curdles into something murderous is very compelling. And the language, the precision, as somebody, as one critic said, I think, some of the sentences here are so beautiful and burnished, you could wear them as jewellery. Now, that's quite rare. There are kind of other Girls on Fire, the Wasserman book, there's kind of the Paula Hawkins, the domestic. There's a lot of good, really tight, taut female authored thrillers out there. And this certainly sits among them. But you've also got, as I say, you've got the big literary hitters coming out and saying, actually, this is great writing. So I can see why it's been successful. For me, the things that don't quite work in it, I think in the end, the squalid horror of what happened in the Manson murders, she kind of doesn't go into, which is fine. But I think there's part of you that sort of thinks, I mean,
you almost owed it or something?
Well, almost you just sort of needed a sense of balance. And the other thing I didn't, the frame, the older EV seems remarkably dull. And you think, how can anybody who in a way has such insight, I mean, it's a problem often in literary fiction, is that what you're told about a character and how they actually, their inner lives don't seem to quite match. But these are very minor quibbles. I mean, I can see this being in, you know, packed away in on holiday reading lists by lots of people this summer.
The Girls by Emma Klein is out now, published by Chatto and Windus. Our final book sees British non-fiction writer Francis Spufford take his first leap into novel writing. Golden Hill is a tale about Mr. Smith, a strange Londoner in New York in 1746, who turns up at a counting house with an order for £1,000. It's an intriguing start from there. How does the story unfold?
It unfolds very cleverly. If you're a fan of 18th century fiction, if you like Fielding or Sterne, then this is really high quality pastiche. He gets the language, I think, pretty much spot on. He gets that sense of a romp. I mean, it kind of is a romp. So Mr. Smith, as he's known, which, I mean, already has all your suspicions kind of on edge, arrives. He presents this money. He's obviously, the people are deeply sceptical. He's come from nowhere. How does he have this? I mean, that's a lot of money in 1746. And gradually, he has to kind of persuade them, the bankers, persuade the various people he meets in coffee houses in New York. And he does this, and he becomes a kind of, he becomes famous overnight because he's wealthy. He then demonstrates that he has a talent for acting. So he seems to know a lot about the world of newspapers. He becomes very intriguing. There's a very well kind of managed love interest, this very aggressive woman called Tabitha, who he kind of flirts with. And gradually and brilliantly orchestrated in this sort of 60-day period, you get an amazing picture of a city that we all feel very familiar with, which is Manhattan, New York. But before it is really New York, it's still a very Dutch city, and a lot of the characters in the book are sort of stolid Dutch kind of burghers. The Broadway that's in the book, there's a huge amount of fun. It reminds me of a wonderful book written a few years ago, A History of New York, called The Island at the Center of the World. But it's, you're getting, he talks about how the city doesn't smell like London smells, and the kind of, you know, there's fresh air, the people seem healthier. But you're given a wonderful series of amazing set pieces, the Guy Fawkes celebration, massive bonfire. Then you have the Dutch Christmas with Sinterklaas and Black Peter. And then you have a period, without giving away too many spoilers, you have the New York jail that he finds himself in for a while. You end up, there is a duel, there is everything you would expect from a fabulous 18th century romp, but with also a brilliant, brilliant reveal at the end, which totally transforms your whole view of the story. If you like historical fiction, which I do, and you want something that is, I think, really original, I've not read a novel set in New York like this before, then I think Spufford, who is again a marvellous writer, there again you find yourself sort of turning over pages and underlining stuff all through the book. And I know there are some people who don't like that, but it's done, I think it's done with a kind of a degree of scholarship. You learn a massive amount about 18th century Manhattan in here.
And I was wondering, I mean, you mentioned the language, he uses a kind of 18th century turn of phrase. Do you think that's a bit of a kind of block for the reader, or does it work?
It's always tricky, isn't it? Is it a block for the reader? I mean, I find novels that are set in historical periods that use modern English more difficult to deal with than the ones that are pastiches. I mean, I think of the novels that I love. I mean, the Paul Kingsnorth being the most recent, where he set a book in at the time of the Norman Conquest and actually invented a language to tell the story in. Or Charles Palliser's great Victorian pastiche, The Quincunx, which was, again, kind of like Dickens on steroids. I don't know. I guess for some people, if you don't like that kind of... I mean, it's done really well, I should say this. For me, it wasn't a barrier. And I think I can't see how he would have told the stories. And there are several letters, for example, that the plot kind of hinges on, that come in from time to time. And again, I think he gets that wonderful kind of sense of the epistolary. There's also, I have to say, and this is something you wouldn't get in directly, there is a rather good sex scene in the book, which I kind of thought, yeah, this is actually his, the sort of decorum that you would, that he applies to it, is sort of makes it work in the plot in a way that it could have been embarrassing. So there's I hope, without giving away too many spoilers, Golden Hill is the place in New York where he first arrives, and where the girl whose father, the Tabitha's father, is the man who in the end gives him the money. But it's, as I say, brilliant reveal. It's a romp. I think the people who are kind of real historical fiction readers will really love this book.
Golden Hill by Frances Spufford is out now, published by Faber and Faber. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks to my guest, John Mitchison. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our film review with Jason Solomons. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks very much for listening.